Hi, in this episode of IB Matters, we talk with John Moore from Shaker Heights, Ohio. The Shaker Heights City Schools have made the choice to detrack their schools in an effort to better prepare all their students for success in high school classes, including their robust IB diploma program. Theirs is a pre-K through 12th grade IB district, and John speaks eloquently about the need to be true to the IB mission and the framework as they work to lift every student. The journey has been and continues to be a challenge, but John ends with a call to action for all of us to join in this work and gives us the resources to begin our own journey to break structural barriers that hold some students back. Welcome to IB Matters, a podcast for those who currently teach, lead, attend, or are interested in International Baccalaureate IB schools. Hi, folks, and welcome back to IB Matters. And I am very excited about our guest today and the topic that we have in front of us. John Moore from Shaker Heights Schools in Ohio is here. And if that name sounds familiar, either John's name or Shaker Heights, it's because what he's here to talk about today has actually been in the real media, so to speak, with New York Times and so on. And we're very excited to have him here. He reached out to us in July, and we've finally been able to get together here and talk about what their school district has done, which is a huge effort and still ongoing and not without growing pains and issues. And we're going to talk about that. But they have worked to detrack courses in their school district so that more kids are prepared and ready for the challenges of an IB education, especially in the high school. So we're going to hear more about that. I want to let John introduce himself. And then, John, why don't you let us know who you are and just tell us a little bit about your background, your school, your district, and how you got to where you are.
You got it. Thanks, John. John Moore, Shaker Heights City Schools. I currently serve as our Director of Curriculum and Instruction, but that position has been informed by almost 12, 13 years as an IB coordinator.
Oh, cool.
I'm a proud diploma program graduate, so I've been involved with the IB since my own education. And it was that experience that actually led me to employment at Shaker Heights.
Oh, neat.
A few years after having taught high school biology, I took on more MYP coordinator responsibilities. We were getting that program online.
Mm-hmm.
We were authorized, and over time, I shifted focus to district coordinating. I was our diploma program coordinator for a while, and now this is year three as the director of curriculum and instruction. And that IB experience is crucial for my position in Shaker Heights because we are so lucky to be authorized PK-12 with IB programs. For us, it is the way that we learn and teach. We have five PYP, so all of our learners are engaged in the primary years program. We have a three-school MYP partnership, and that culminates in our diploma program at our single high school. Shaker Heights is an incredibly special place. It's a hugely diverse community outside of Cleveland, Ohio. Commitment to diversity, equity, and inclusion is serious. We were one of the first school districts to voluntarily integrate post Brown versus Board of Education. Mm-hmm. And the work since then has been iterative. And I'm excited today to share a little bit about what that work looks like in the 2000s. Huge, huge socioeconomic, ethnic, racial diversity. We're about 45% Black student population, 40 mm-hmm. white, 10 multiracial, and many others beyond that. And again, the socioeconomic range is huge. That's one of the beautiful aspects of Shaker Heights, is that many of our community members, no matter where they fall in the socioeconomic spectrum, send their kids to Shaker. It's mm-hmm. it's a blessing, it's a challenge, and it has a direct impact on what we'll be talking about today.
Oh, that's great. I mean, it sometimes you don't find that in schools that are, outside big metro areas, that the parents aren't necessarily confident in the local public schools. And it sounds like, and I'm impressed by the size. I didn't realize you were as big a district as you are to have, five PYP schools and go up from there. So incredible that you're doing that. Those of you that are listening and are familiar with the Cleveland area, it's definitely, Ohio is a really interesting state. It's a very diverse state, and I think it's it adds to the interest here for me that you are where you are doing this kind of work, because this might be easy in a really small enclave, so to speak. But like you said, you've got the entire world coming to you, and you've got a very diverse school to do this kind of work. So it's credit to you, and I look forward to hearing more.
I appreciate that, John. We've got about 4,500 students spanning the grade bands here. And our population, despite the demographics of Ohio actually shrinking, we have maintained a pretty stable enrollment. We honestly attribute quite a bit of that to IB and our commitment to IB. We get families who one of their first questions upon moving in is, tell me more about IB. Again, what's valuable about what we'll talk about today with detracking or destreaming is we are seriously, seriously committed to that IB education for all, not just in name,
right,
but in authenticity and in the experiences of each child.
Yeah, that's great. And I was telling you before we started recording that here in Minnesota, we have several schools that have worked or are working on and have already developed IB for all scenarios, and we're encouraging more of our schools to do that. So this will help inform that too. For the sake of our listeners, and especially since we have listeners from all over the globe, and you and I have both used the term detrack a little bit, would you want to just give our listeners a little primer on what tracking is here in the United States? And I'm not sure if it's common everywhere, but what do we mean when we say tracking? And then that'll help us understand better when we talk about detracking.
You got it, John. And for our international listeners, oftentimes this might be considered streaming or ability grouping. These are other euphemisms for this idea of tracking. And when I talk about tracking, I talk about a systematic approach to separating students into different levels or different courses based upon perceived ability, prior academic history, et cetera. In Shaker, this was particularly nefarious. Again, I'm not suggesting folks did this consciously, but the outcome of this tracking system was, starting in about fifth grade, young people were sorted either into enriched courses, honors courses, some may call them, or what we would call core or on grade level courses. And John, the problem with that was that these courses or these tracks were sticky. Mm-hmm. Once you were on the track and starting in fifth grade, if I were a betting man, I could probably tell you what kinds of classes you'd be sitting in 12th grade.
Right.
And odds were, if you were in that core fifth grade math and language, et cetera, odds were you were not engaged in programs like our diploma program or our college career or college credit plus programs, et cetera. And so these tracks, once begun, you were set up systemically pretty much. If you were in core fifth, odds were you were in core six and core seventh and so on and so forth.
Right, right.
This was really impacting math in particular. Yep. Algebra 1 was a huge predictor of high school success. And again, in Shaker, because of that diversity we have, we had a big opportunity. But when we looked at tracking, John, I'm going to call it what it was. We weren't splitting kids. We were segregating kids. Because what happened between that honors and core, those courses, was that it was splitting almost 100% based on race. And that was something that just morally and frankly, academically, we got to a point a few years ago where we were not going to engage in that racist practice anymore. And that's really what started this journey of undoing those systemic barriers.
Yeah. Yeah. So when you say we, you know, decided this thing, this takes a lot of effort and leadership to do that. Where did this intentional detracking or removing of these streams and tracks, where did that come from? Did it come from the community? Did it come from the leadership in your district? Where did that come from?
Excellent question. Part of it was in 2019, the district adopted its first educational equity policy. And in that policy, it explicitly states some of the challenges that we were seeing and our responsibility to address those challenges. And so an examination of the systemic barriers was really important, and detracking was probably top of the list of issues we needed to address. I give credit to our current superintendent, Dr. David Glasner. He was our middle school principal. He saw the impacts of tracking, the segregation of our children firsthand for years. In fact, he studied it when he pursued his dissertation. Flash forward, in 2020, as you know as well as I, the world in so many ways shut down.
Right.
And sort of Rahm Emanuel, I think it was President Obama's education secretary at the time, he has a pretty infamous or famous quote about never let a good crisis go to waste. During that pandemic, in order to reopen, we had to do some creative things, and the state of Ohio was encouraging us to do that. Things like podding children so that, you know, they were in the same pods or groups throughout the day.
Sure.
With John, in a tracked system, if you pod, not only is math being segregated and Lang and Lit, but everything would be, because as soon as you solidify those tracks or courses across every subject, physical and health education, arts, music, band, et cetera, you have essentially created two separate schools. Those ideas, I think, combined is what really built an urgency and a deep commitment to this work. So it was actually the pandemic year, 2020, was our first year of having D-tracked courses where all of our students were integrated in the subjects.
Well, I was going to ask you, you know, how you prepared this. You know, there's no way you can just rip the Band-Aid off and do this super quick, but it sounds like you actually ended up doing it super, super quick in response to the COVID necessities. Is that true?
That is true. And in fact, John, I think oftentimes people will say, they'll use that term just as you did. You know, you ripped the Band-Aid off. We needed more time, more training, more resources. And there are elements of that where I do understand the perspective and I empathize with teachers' experiences, for example. I've also, I challenged that a little bit. I think there are pros and cons to each. And in fact, I was talking with a researcher last week from Rowan University. She's interested in pursuing some research around this. And she's done past research about detracking. And I said that to her, John. I said, we get a lot of criticism for not doing this more incrementally. Mm-hmm. And I was pleasantly surprised to hear her response. She said, you know, yes and no. The challenge with incremental steps is you give people a long time to languish,
yeah,
a long time to reminisce, be nostalgic, be anxious for how we used to do things. You've essentially stretched that period out. Now, that's not to say that we are not seriously committed to professional learning and other resources. We should talk more about that today. But I think she helped me to really see and encourage me at some of the more positive elements of this. I'm thinking of one other thing. There's a great equity researcher, Gorski, and he talks about one of the equity detours being pacing for privilege. Hmm. His point is, when you're doing equity work, if you wait for people to become comfortable with that work, you're going to be waiting forever.
Right.
And we can debate, you know, right, wrong, or different how we did this, but there are some clear benefits to the way that we did it. And frankly, we're spending a lot of time now providing some of those additional resources and learning for our community that, yes, would have been nice. And we're making up for that now, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's one way to look at it is, you know, you don't really know what you need until you've taken the turn the other direction. And so now, oh yeah, it would have been good to know that. But if you're doing it, like you said, the waiting till everyone's comfortable, everyone's going to want, it's kind of like the argument that's made for not moving forward on big social issues. Oh, we need more research. We need more research.
Right.
Anytime anyone wants to hold you off, and I've heard this in education too, it's like, well, do you have data? You know, we need research. Tell us, you know, how to do that. And not that data and collecting data and educational research isn't important, but you've got a laboratory that you're in the middle of right now. I'm sure that you have had a pushback and the resistance that you encountered having done this so quickly. How did you, you know, I mean, obviously COVID was sitting there in your circumstance, so you could kind of go, yeah, we kind of had to do this for the reasons you just explained. But I'm sure, knowing teachers that I've worked with and, you know, teachers that continue to work with, that there must have been some resistance and there must have been some you're completely changing the way I do business and I don't have any tools to do so.
That's right, John. I would say that and community understanding, I would say, are our two primary challenges that we've really been focused on addressing. I'll take one at a time.
Sure.
From a teacher's standpoint, we are asking them to differentiate in ways that yes, typically in a track system, the breadth of student experience or readiness, it's smaller in those systems. So we are asking our teachers to ramp up on differentiation. Some of the resources that have been helpful with that, particularly around math, is a lot of the work we're seeing coming out of California around Joe Bowler's work and how you help all young people excel in math. We've done some work with Carol Ann Tomlinson on differentiation. We've sent folks to gifted training around differentiating up with Richard Cash. A lot of that professional learning around how do you meet the needs of each child when the game has changed, when you have mm-hmm. more children with different needs than you ever had before. This is a space where I really give credit to the IB, particularly our MYP program. I have always believed in our district, the value of the middle years program was on helping our teachers collaborate across those levels. John, consider it. Enriched honors, whatever you want to call it, teachers were coming together to plan units of inquiry with shared concepts, right. shared labs, you know, these shared right. Socratic seminars, et cetera. I truly believe if we hadn't had that, this whole thing would have been on shaky right. ground from go. Right. But the reality was, because IB was pushing us to embrace those best practices that we know work for all children, that was a huge, huge leg up. And in fact, it speaks to, again, this researcher from Rowan who said, what she is finding is schools who do detracking well have a strong, strong instructional basis yeah. on which to make this transition. And she says to me, she says, you know, and if you're not familiar with the IB, you should. And I said, well, yeah.
Well, thank you. I am.
And this Hello. Is great news.
yeah. Well, it's so cool because you're anticipating my next questions each time you yeah. speak. Because I was, while you're talking about this preparation and helping teachers deal with the differentiation and so on, I've always felt like the MYP has the central DNA of the IB through it. And the fact that the assessment methods, I was going to ask you, how healthy did you feel that your MYP programs were? Because a good, healthy MYP where the teachers are collaborating and are understanding the assessment process already has differentiation built into it, because those criteria that you use allow for a big difference in students, but also to see that you can encourage students at all levels of the assessment strata, so to speak, to see where they are and where to go next, and whether that kid is a gifted and talented kid or a kid struggling to kind of catch up with their peers, they both have tools and a ladder which they can climb.
I think you nailed it, John. From my perspective, there is so much good baked into the MYP that facilitates this change. And I'm not saying it's not a lot of hard work and that have, you know, a long journey to continuously improve our programs, but inherently, and I'm going to say this actually on two sides of the coin, John, inherently the IB programs are set up in a way to accelerate this kind of change, to support districts, classrooms, teachers to embrace learning and assessment that provides voice and choice and agency in all that we do. Inherently, that is good for differentiation and good for kids. Now, the other side of that coin, John, is that to a certain extent, I think fully embracing the IB's philosophy, the way we do business, is incongruous with tracking. I think that's what we discovered that's right. as part that's of right. our equity reflections and the policy. We said, you know, if we really believe in what the IB is sharing around our values for education, we need to make efforts. We need to address the barriers in the system to make sure that each child genuinely has access to that kind of learning. And in some ways, John, it's an expectations game.
Yeah.
We reshuffle the expectations for who can do what, who benefits from what kind of learning and projects and assessments, as you mentioned. And now I think through addressing this issue in the system, we have shown how deeply committed we are that you can do that high quality unit and a bang up assessment, and we're going to see each child thrive.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, what we see in the research, and I was seeing with my own eyes as director of curriculum, was that what can typically happen in tracked classes in those core classes, naturally, subconsciously, our expectations lower.
Yeah.
And we see less rigorous, less challenging. You see those MYP or IB assessments, they're a little softer, they're not as authentic. Meanwhile, you have those enriched and honors classes, and there's Socratic seminars, and there's debates, and there's projects, there's this community involvement. And we said, we have to address that. And now it's really important that when we talk about detracting, we talk about leveling up. Mm-hmm. The idea is not that we're reducing expectations for classes. No, no, no. We are ensuring that each child is getting that IB experience. Yeah. That's really important. That gets to the community perceptions, I think, piece of this, or at least concern.
Yeah.
That we have somehow maybe watered down our curriculum, or you know, we're going to have behavioral issues and so on and so forth. I'm happy to tell you now, we don't hang our hats completely on state assessment data or achievement data or, you know, these sorts of things. But the data initially, John, is pretty good. In mm-hmm. fact, much better than what we would anticipate coming out of the pandemic. So some of this is going to take time. Some of it was really important to do in and of itself, no matter what the data says, yeah. even though it looks pretty darn good.
Sure. So let me zoom out a little bit. Yeah. And I'm just going to quickly touch on, you know, a couple of terms. We talked about IB for all, and that, in my experience, technically or usually refers to high school students who are included in, for example, it happens a lot with a course called IB Lang and Lit, or Language and Literature, that is offered as the standard English class for every student in the school, so that every kid is in there. And when they talk about IB for all, it's usually that, and maybe a couple different offerings in the maths that that are accessible to every kid, as long as they are kind of ready to go. Math is a little bit different animals, you know. But let me then go back. You mentioned early on about kids getting into the tracking world or tracked courses as early as fifth or sixth grade, which takes us to PYP, the tail end of PYP. What happens in the elementary school where PYP exists to help give these kids an expectation that they are all going to move through, and when they get to fifth or sixth grade, whatever your culminating year of PYP is, that they are just as ready as their peers to go on and have those opportunities when they're older?
I'm excited to talk a little bit about our PYP and the work of our coordinators at each school. It's important, I think, to note that pre-PYP for us, we were doing some practices that I think are pretty clear in the research now, and certainly in the philosophy of IB, that are not good for learners. We were doing things like pull out gifted and enrichment. Again, mm-hmm. we were in some ways starting tracking even before that fifth grade, which, for the record, mm-hmm. fifth grade is our first year of MYP.
Okay, there you go.
Yeah. However, again, thinking about the way that IB is impacting these systems towards equity, with the adoption of PYP, we completely flipped the script on what gifted services or enrichment looks like at elementary. And it lines up beautifully well now with our initiatives around detracking. Consider this: if you come to any of our primary years program buildings, you will see IB coordinators when they're not facilitating really important collaborative planning time and doing their other important work. They'll actually be pushing in to each of the classes and doing really interesting, engaging, enriching design lessons, sort of aligned with our MYP. Yeah. And the function of that is to really focus on that creative problem solving, those skills that are oftentimes needed to stretch our gifted learners or our enriched learners. Now, the reality is, what we have seen absolutely is that those kinds of strategies have been excellent at supporting the learning of all of our students. It would do no good for us, I think, to detrack our middle years program and then be doing some strategies at elementary, like pulling kids out or separating them for gifted, et cetera. So really, our commitment to serving children in an inclusive, integrated, heterogeneous environments, you're right, John, that really is important to do at the ground level up, starting mm-hmm. with our PYP.
Well, that's really cool. And I love the kind of the like the flip the script idea that it's like, you know, going in. And I just, when you said design, I was like, a smile came across my face, because one of the coolest things, I was a science teacher also, by the way, like you. And one of the coolest things is to see design added in integrally, that's not, a, is that a word?
I'm with you.
Integrated way to education, because in the MYP and the PYP both, it's such a big part of it. And I think we haven't given it enough credit in the past for the understanding, because design is, to me, it's one of those things that you don't know who has design skills, and kids think outside the box all the time. They understand aesthetic, but they also understand how to get things done. And design is crosses over so many subject areas and also skill sets. I think it's great that that's one of the ways that they get entree into those, into the classrooms with the PYP coordinators. Now, you mentioned, you've hinted at a couple of successes that you've already experienced. Some of your, you know, like I said, you don't hang your hat on them, but some test scores look good. What's kind of the, you know, use a really official term, what's the vibe? What's the feeling, you know, with all the different stakeholders, the kids, the teachers, the parents, even the leadership?
Yeah, the vibe is mixed, I would say, John, depending on who you ask and sometimes which day you ask them. And sure. I'll tell you why. I think folks in our community genuinely support philosophically what we are doing. This idea of integrating our courses is so vital, I think, to our next step towards equity. You know, we've known for a long time that segregating schools was bad. We've known that that is not a good practice. And yet many schools across the U.S. and world, we find a way to be comfortably numb around segregating kids in courses. You know, somehow we find a way to be okay with that. I think our community supports us and understands the need for this. Where we're getting some of our challenges or concerns is, are we meeting the needs? Are we truly meeting the needs of all of those learners? That includes interventions for young people who may have been hit hardest during the pandemic or are having long-term effects from that. Are we challenging our learners who are oftentimes working a grade or two ahead? And that's a lot for a teacher to stretch. So I want to tell you some of the things that we have in place to sort of help with that. One, we are blessed, and it's critical to our professional learning. We are blessed to have an IB coordinator and an instructional coach who, along with the principal of each building, is seriously and deeply committed to co-planning, co-teaching, co-assessing, really being an integral part of this change as sort of a lifeline to help teachers be successful in this endeavor. A really great example of this is our middle school math teams. And that middle school math team is so committed to using their collaborative planning time to experiences of all kinds for all children, and leaning on each other to develop activities, stations, rotations, so on and so forth, so that each child can find a place in their classes every day. I wish that you all could see this, because this is the future we're trying to create. When we talk about the challenges of detracking, but then you see a class like that, you get it. You get it in about an instant, where you see this heterogeneous group of young people, peer learning, peer teaching, engaged in deep, deep learning. You get it. To that end, we actually, knowing that we have a ways to go in helping to continue build this understanding, we're going to have what we're calling a superintendent series this fall on detracking. We've asked some of our math teachers and our lang-lit teachers to do demo lessons with our community members. So we're actually going to have parents and community members coming in and be the students for about an hour or so, where they can experience. They've heard a lot about detracking. I think that they get it. If they live it, I think they'll get it even better.
Have you had community members leave because of this, or, you know, take their kids elsewhere, or thinking that it wasn't going to work for their children?
I'm sure that's happened, John. Sometimes we get that kind of threat. I will tell you, though, from a database level, we keep track of enrollment data. And in fact, we'll present that data to the board next month. We're right online with predictions. Detracking aside, pandemic aside, all of these other issues aside, the demographic shifts in Ohio and the impact to our school district, we're right on par. So we recognize, I recognize that if a parent is not satisfied with having their child be in this kind of learning environment, they may choose an alternative for themselves. But my hope, particularly with opportunities like this, opportunities like author Laura Meckler's Dreamtown book that hit the stage, we're getting a lot more positive attention than negative. And I want to believe that if we cast the net wide enough, we're going to find far more people interested in integrating classes than having segregated classes. So I just see us as having a lot more to gain than lose on this issue. And not just ethically. That's the thing. This is an inherently good decision. And I think people understand that. But the point I really want to make is that it's good academically as well. That's what the research tells us. That's what we're seeing in our own data, yet it's early. When you detrack students who might have been in that former core level or on-grid level, they make tremendous gains. And it costs the students who formerly might have been in the enriched or honors or whatever you might have called it, it costs them nothing. They are neutrally to positively impacted. And that's on academic data, not to mention the value of working in a diverse learning environment. So I just see it as a win-win. We are moving through the challenges, but I really believe we're going to be better on the other side.
Yeah. And this fear of, it's one of the ways people detract from things like this is that they think it's a zero-sum game, and the fact that the fact that your child will be negatively impacted when other children succeed and rise, and it's not the case. You I don't know where I saw this. Either was in our communications or what might have been in the article. And by the way, I think I said New York Times. It's actually the Washington Post that posted that article. That it, somewhere in there, I think I read that your initial results on kids taking up IB courses, diploma program courses, has shown an increase of students who traditionally weren't in those classes. Can you share some of that data?
Yeah, I'd love to. And again, I think the example I'll give speaks to the power of detracking. Prior to detracking Algebra 1, about 50%, let's say 50-45% of our students took Algebra 1 in eighth grade, nearly exclusively white. That was the impact of the tracking. And many of our Black youth would go on to high school and begin their Algebra 1 journey there. Today, all of our students are in Algebra 1 in eighth grade. And that's had huge implications for curriculum instruction. And we've had to do a lot of vertical articulation starting at that fifth grade level. But I want to flash forward to last year. Half of our Black students are showing competency on their graduation test requirement. In Ohio, you have to get a certain score in Algebra 1 before they even step foot in our high school.
Wow.
That number before, and let me be clear, 50%, my gosh, do we have a ways to go? And we're committed to that. But let me be clear, before it was 5 or fewer percent because of how tracked the system might have been. Mm-hmm. And so what you're seeing is the knock-on effect of having that level of expectation, preparation for our students. We're seeing upticks in IBDP. We're seeing upticks in AP. I see this as an opportunity to grow all of our pathways, career tech ed, college credit plus, all of these pathways. Our goal is that they are genuine options for each of our children. And as a district, we've done our due diligence, our duty, our responsibility to make sure that these are legitimate choices for each child.
Yeah. You're not just throwing them to the shark, so to speak. They're prepared for that. Yeah. That's really good data. And I don't know how familiar you are with Minnesota's education systems, but we're usually on, top 5 or top 10 lists for education in the state, but we are number 50 in terms of disparity for racial groups in our state. So it's a kind of a shameful situation. And I think that's part of what the interest is in including this kind of work in our state, and specifically in the IB schools, our Association of IB Schools, which is somewhere in the 60 schools. We can have an impact on that by really taking this cause up. And I love to hear the way it's working for you in Shaker Heights, and knowing that there are going to be challenges and bumps on the road as there continue to be. But that goes without saying. I mean, if you thought this would be easy, or if anyone thought this would be easy, they were not in education. You know, that's
right. Well, and frankly, more people would be doing it. Yeah. There is a growing network, and I'm really excited to connect with our colleagues in Minnesota and learn more about the work that you all are doing. This is a growing network. I think that people are recognizing the need to address some of these systemic barriers. Let's not do it alone. Yeah. One of my hopes from this podcast, from the articles you've mentioned, et cetera, is we're having other schools reaching out to us saying, tell us more. How might we engage in this? How might IB help us to do that? There is power in numbers. Yeah. And there's I think there's powerful learning to be had as we each make this really important journey.
Yeah, no, that's great. And so on that note, getting started, I mean, hopefully we don't have another pandemic to force our hand, but sure. But what advice would you give? You know, because I think it's important, as you said, to do this on a relative, don't wait till you're comfortable. You know, what would advice do you have for people that are moving this direction or would like to, and, you know, they want to, you know, they might be an IB coordinator, or they might be a teacher, or they might be a lone principal in a big district saying, hey, I really want to do this. And everything seems to be working against you, or you don't feel like you have the power to, you know, move forward on this thing that's clearly ethically correct. And as you pointed out, also educationally correct. What advice do you have?
It's a great question. I think one big opportunity that we still have and would be a first step recommendation for me is communication, communication, communication. Taking great efforts on making this a grassroots initiative with buy-in from teachers, from community members. In order to get that buy-in, I think there needs to be some deep, deep work, professional learning and research around general topics around diversity, equity, and inclusion. A study of why tracking exists. When you hear more about the history of it, it makes it almost more shameful. Mm-hmm. To build a little bit of that buy-in, so that the need is identified. And I think once people understand that need, they're willing to cope with and overcome the inherent challenges that are going to come with any change this size. Essentially, we've changed the entire district, as any detracking initiative would. Having that deep understanding and buy-in, and the earlier you can build that, I think the better. A phenomenal place to start. A couple of resources that come to my mind. A phenomenal place to start. Detracking for Equity and Excellence, Carol Burris, Delia Garrity. It's actually Carol was principal, I believe, at the time of an IB school. So there's a real clear connection with International Baccalaureate there. The Bridges Collaborative. The Bridges Collaborative, it's a nonprofit organization. They've got amazing resources on detracking. I would suggest anyone interested in this topic starts there. And another podcast, actually, there's a podcast, Teaching While White. They've actually done a little series on tracking, the deleterious effects of tracking, how one might start the detracking or de-streaming journey. I think that those resources are a great place to get people interested. And once you've got them interested and they understand why this is a compelling issue, if you get your teachers on board, members of the community, I think that's going to address 90%+ of the challenges you could anticipate.
Yeah, I could see a model where you'd have spent a year just getting a background and having discussion groups, much like a book club, and just kind of talk through these things and have background information. In fact, I'm if those of you listening from Minnesota right now, this podcast is going to be a prerequisite to for our next meeting. So I'm hoping obviously I'm not going to keep track, but I'm hoping that you listen to this so that when we talk about these issues in our September 27th meeting, that you're going to have some of this background and maybe even have dug into the resources. Listeners know that I always have a list of resources in the podcast notes, and I'll include the things that John just talked about, including the Washington Post article, and then the Detracking for Equity and Excellence, a number of other resources he's provided, including the Teaching While White podcast episodes 24, 5, and 6. So that looks like a great way for people to get the background. And I'm going to go find those myself and read those as well, because it'll be really helpful for me to, as we move forward in our work here in Minnesota. And for those of you listening elsewhere, all over the world, whatever issues you have, I'm sure you know what we're talking about. John, I really appreciate your time. Absolutely. Is there anything else you wanted to make sure you shared today? I'm looking forward to a continued collaboration with you. We talked off the air a little bit ago about, you know, maybe having a follow-up. We'll be doing some work with our Minnesota school examples as well. And I think this will end up in a bit of a series here for the IB Matters podcast. So any other ideas or any other thoughts that you have, you'd like to make sure you shared with us?
Yeah, John, I appreciate the opportunity. My parting words might be particularly for IB schools who I think are committed to equity or providing a true IB education for each child. This is a call to action. Mm-hmm. And I want to just note that we're all, or many of us, we're going through this journey. We're going through this process, and it's a learning process. And that the more we can be networked, the more that we can connect across schools and talk about this journey, the better each of our children or all of our children are for it. So it's a call to action and a commitment to networking so that we can make this impact across the nation.
Yeah, great. Oh, that's awesome. And then we do have our own IB Matters email address that I share in every one of our podcasts. I don't know if you want to share any socials or anything, John. I don't want to make you the face of this for the entire world, but to the extent you want to share any information or continue to help collaborate with this, we will share that with folks. Well, thank you so much for your time today and sharing this amazing story and this journey that you've been on at Shaker Heights. I am so impressed, and I know our listeners will be as well. So thanks again for your time today.
Absolutely, John. It's been an honor, truly.
All right, great. You can learn much more about detracking using links in our podcast notes. Please reach out to John or myself if you have questions or if you have a story to tell about your own school's work in this area. Now that we have over 100 IB Matters episodes covering a range of subjects, you can use our podcast webpage, which is organized by program and by topic. The link to the website is also in our podcast notes. Please find all of our episodes wherever you get your podcasts and click subscribe so you don't miss any future programs. Join our over 3,000 followers on X at MattersIB. Also help us spread the word about IB by liking, sharing, and reviewing the IB Matters links in your own feeds and social networks. In our time on the air, we've been heard in over 160 countries, a testament to the global reach of the IB.